Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Anthony Cao. My guest today is Scott Simon. Scott is a professor of sociological and anthropological studies at the University of Ottawa, where he is also the co-chair of Taiwan Studies. He specializes in the political anthropology of Taiwan's indigenous peoples. Naturally, this is a subject in his latest book, Truly Human, Indigeneity and Indigenous Resurgence on Formosa, published April 2023, by the University of Toronto Press. The book encapsulates over two decades of ethnographic field research that Scott did alongside Dasidic and Truku indigenous peoples in Taiwan. It delves deep into different aspects of their lives, hunting practices, belief systems, electoral politics, storytelling, and more. Scott, thanks for coming on the New Books Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to share my new book with you.
And happy to talk with you about your book as well. Well, let's dive in then. How about you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up focusing on indigeneity and indigenous peoples on Taiwan?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good place to start. In fact, one of the things I've learned from the Algonquin people where I live now in Canada is that all knowledge is situated in the person that holds that knowledge. And so I think it really is an important question. And, you know, it started when I was an undergraduate. And I needed to take a foreign language, and I had an opportunity to learn Chinese. So I took Chinese as my foreign language and went to China and really got hooked. So Chinese became my undergraduate major. So when I went to grad school, I think it was rather obvious to me that I would do something in the Chinese world. And things didn't work out. It was a bit too expensive to go to mainland China. And so I ended up in Taiwan instead. I did research on the leather tanning industry for my PhD research in Tainan. Nothing to do with indigenous peoples at all so far, right? I was very lucky. I was at the Institute of Ethnology, where I am right now, as a doctoral fellow. And then I got a job in Taiwan. And then I got a postdoctoral fellowship at Academia Sinica's Institute of Sociology. And I was teaching part-time anthropology. And it's then when I met a woman. Her photo is actually on page 59 here of the book, and it's dedicated to her among those who have passed away since I started doing the research. But Igong Shiban, who is Durugu, said to me at that time, "Why are you doing all this research with these Han people in Taipei who are the elite in Taiwan? You should be studying and doing research with us, the indigenous people, because we are the most marginalized, poorest people in Taiwan, and we really need your research and your help." And so she kind of recruited me. She was a social activist. She was working with environmentalists and indigenous rights groups in protests against the Asia Cement Corporation that was mining on her territory. And so I just jumped in. I helped her write an article about the mining industry. And then when I got my job in Canada, she was really upset. And she said, "I'll never see you again." And I said, "Igong, you'll see me every single year. I promise you that for my entire career, I will come back and I will do research." And then I got money from the Canadian government to do research with her group. And so I spent the last 20 years doing that. So that's how I got into it. I was recruited.
Wow. Sounds like a really opportune story that ended up working out quite well. Well, in this case, can you tell us a little bit more about the context of the indigenous people of Taiwan and the Sidik and Turuku people specifically?
Yeah. So basically, you know, we talk about indigenous peoples all over the world now. And, you know, like there's the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And so people often ask me this question, well, how does Taiwan fit in there? And, you know, I'll explain it, that it's basically part of the same historical process of how all of these peoples got the category of the legal category of being indigenous. And it has to do with the expansion of the European capitalist economy around the world. And I think you've probably heard sometime people talking about the doctrine of discovery. And that was, you know, the Pope basically announced this doctrine of discovery that if Europeans and Christians go any place in the world where there are stateless primitive peoples who don't believe in Christianity, they have the right to move in there and take over territory and convert people. And so because, you know, China and Japan and so forth had modern states for their time, so they didn't go and colonize them, but they went to places like North America and South America. And Taiwan at that time in the 1600s didn't have a state. It was not part of China. It was not part of Japan, even though Chinese and Japanese sometimes, you know, landed here and did things and then left. But there were no states. There was a bunch of stateless peoples living quite happily in the forests, in the mountains, on the coasts, living their lives in small, closely knit communities. And so the Dutch wanted to have a colony in China, and China said, no, you can't do that. But there's this other island, and you can go there. And so the Dutch went there. And gradually over time, the Dutch were there. They got kicked out by a rebel Ming Dynasty guy named Koxinga or Zheng Chengong. And then he got kicked out by the Qing Dynasty. And then they brought in settlers from China and they moved up the coast. But they never conquered those high mountain areas. And so until the Japanese took it in 1895, those mountainous areas in the central and east coast were still autonomous and living their traditional life with no state. And, you know, they might have traded with people on the outside, but they had no state and they were really autonomous, democratic, really radically democratic societies. And so it was the Japanese who first incorporated them into a state. And then the Republic of China, Chiang Kai-shek, came and they kind of inherited that system. But that's the origin of how they became indigenous. And what I find really interesting about the Sedek and Turugu, they're very closely related, are that they were the last group to be incorporated into a state. And it was the Turugu in Hualien in 1914. So from Japan got there in 1895. It took nearly 20 years until 1914 before the Turugu agreed to enter into a new relationship with Japan. And Japan had one of the most modern militaries at the time, and the Turugu had hunting rifles and some, you know, bows and arrows, and fought them for 90 days before they finally decided there was nothing they could do and they surrendered. So that's the specialty of the Sedek and Turugu, is their spirit of resistance. And the Sedek, they also rebelled in 1930. And so that's what drew me, I think. I was, Igonga had that, you know, she was resisting Asia's cement. She had that spirit. And I think that's something that I've always admired.
Well, we'll get to the spirit of resistance and the incident in 1930 a little bit later in this conversation. But I do want to start off with the first part of the book, where you explore the roles that forest animals play in Sedek and Turugu life. Tell us more about this and how issues like indigenous hunting rights have even made it to Taiwan Supreme Court within the recent few years.
Yeah, I think this is really important, the relationship with animals in the forest. And it really is the core of their identity today. And, you know, when I first went there to do research, I had some graduate students. We had two, one from Taiwan and one from Canada. And they gave us all animal names because animals are important to them. So they called the one guy a muntjac. They said his face was long and narrow, like that little deer that's called a muntjac. And the Taiwanese guy, he had a little mustache, and they said he looked like a flying squirrel. So they called him Lapit, flying squirrel. And they called me. They said, you're the big one. We're going to call you Kumai, which means bear. And they said, we're going to watch you carefully. And if we think you have the right moral characteristics, if you're a good enough person, then we're going to give you a real Turugu name. But they started with animals. And they did finally give me a Turugu name. But they started with animals. And so it's really important for the men to hunt. And so, in fact, they say that to be a real man, snowbala, you have to be able to hunt. And so they start out, you know, taking their small boys to climb in the mountains, and they teach them to hunt, well, you know, rats and birds and so forth. And then finally they graduate up to flying squirrels, and then finally the real game animals. It's really, really important to them. And in fact, they say that it's important to them as kind of a ritual. It's the way that they engage with the ancestral spirits and the mountain spirits. And they say it replaced their old rituals. And so it's very important then that they can hunt. But then the state says we got to protect all of these animals. And so they created a legal framework in which basically in most situations, hunting is criminalized for one reason or another. The big one being that the big portion of Taiwan consists of national parks. It's illegal to hunt in national parks. And basically the law says that they can hunt if they have their own homemade rifle. See, these homemade rifles are very dangerous. They get these parts at the hardware store, carve some wood, use some metal tubing, use these BB pellets, they can't use modern ammunition and so forth. So they use the firecrackers power, the powder for that fire powder. It's very dangerous. And sometimes they injure themselves. And so I think that's one of the biggest problems. But what happened was that there was this guy, we call him Dama Dalren, means father, Dama. And he went hunting for his mother who wanted a muntjac, the little deer, and a sara, which is like a mountain goat. So he did that, but he took a modern rifle with him. And then he was arrested. He was charged with a lot of charges because he had the wrong kind of rifle. He took two endangered animals. And so it went to the Constitutional Court, and they basically said that the laws against hunting should be upheld, that being indigenous, even though the law says that indigenous people have the right to hunt, doesn't mean you can hunt endangered species. So you have to only hunt the animals that are not endangered. And then there's the rule about the hunting rifles being homemade. They said, that's okay, but the law is not clear enough. We're going to make you, the government has to write a clear law about that. And there was a ridiculous rule that all of the hunters hate that says that in order to hunt legally, you have to go to the local government and you have to register, and you're going to have to tell them on which day you're going to hunt and where you're going to hunt and which animal you're going to catch. And the animal, the hunters always say, well, there's no way we can know that because it's the ancestors who give us a dream and then tell us when and where to go hunting. And the ancestors give us the animal. We can't determine ourselves in advance. They say, you know, it's not like making an appointment with your dentist. You know, you can't just call up and say to the boar, I want to go catch a boar today. And so they find it all completely unreasonable. And so the government, the court decided that they have to make some adjustments to the regulations, but they still uphold all of that. And so the indigenous people were very upset with the courts for that decision.
Well, another thing that the book addresses in the next section is this trope that Han people in Taiwan, I guess the people who were making the laws that we were just talking about, often associate with indigenous peoples, which is the practice of headhunting. Mm-hmm. What is headhunting? And can you help us move beyond tropes to understand the context and the narratives behind this practice?
Yeah, I that's a very important issue, and it's a very touchy and controversial one as well. But basically what's happened is that the non-indigenous have used these stories about headhunting to say that these were all primitives, violent, they need to be controlled. And so it kind of promoted a really racist worldview about them. And what's interesting is beginning in the 90s, they started to really embrace their history because indeed they did have a ritual in which they would take a human head. And so people talk about it. They try to recreate it sometimes in these public rituals. They're quite proud of it now. And so I went back into the Japanese era writings and talked to people about it and tried to reconstruct what it was all about, and came to the conclusion that it was basically a way of managing relations with other communities that can be hostile. And managing it in a way which I argue, and people agreed with me with this, is that it's a way of actually controlling homicides. And as you know, you're in California right now. There are lots of homicides in the United States, right? And so what it is that it sets up a ritual situation in which you can only do the homicide if you've done the right rituals. It can only happen at a certain time of year. And so it's actually very hard for it to happen. And what happens is one of the contexts in which it would be happen is for a conflict resolution. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, they didn't have courts and judges and all that. But let's say there's two people in a community who have a disagreement about something. Maybe one person accuses the other one of having stolen something, and that person says, well, I didn't do it. Both sides claim they're right. The leaders in the community can't negotiate. And they finally say, okay, both of you, you try to convince a group of people to go with you way through the mountains to a faraway place, and then you're going to set up a hut in front of somebody else's village and do some rituals. They're all going to notice you're there, and then you're going to kill somebody and bring back a head. Now, that's really hard to do. And then if one of them comes back successfully with a head, then they'll bring it into the community and they all dance and sing, and that person is proven by the ancestors that they're right. On the other hand, it's very likely that they won't come back successfully at all because of all those conditions I just said. And it's also possible that they could get killed by those other people. It's also possible there could be an injury, in which case they would have to come back into the community naked and in shame. And so I really think that it's the word in their language is magaya, which means the implementation of the sacred law. And so it was a very, very important thing for them in the pre-colonial period. But I think it put a lid on homicidal tendencies that exist in all communities. And so most likely there was actually a far lower homicide rate in that society than there is in the United States right now. So, and when you compare this particular practice, which sounds really cruel and inhumane, it is, the taking of human life, it still pales in comparison to things like, you know, atomic bombs, concentration camps, all of the things of modernity. And so I think there's some beauty there that they found a way of controlling homicidal tendencies, which are human.
Well, talking about sacred laws, which you brought up just a few moments ago, I want to talk about the next chapter after the one where you talk about the headhunting, where we move on to a discussion about belief systems. Tell us more about how Christianity exists alongside these traditional indigenous beliefs, and also the social political role that Christianity plays for the Sedic and Turku people.
Okay, yeah. So basically the word Gaia, we often translate it as a law. We say ancestral law, sacred law, etc. But it can also be culture. It can also be the traditional religion. And so the core of Gaia is that it's the moral principles of sharing, taking care of your family, taking care of your community. There's that relationship with the ancestors that have passed on and are in the mountains now. And so it really is a religious system. The most important ritual in it, there was Magaya I just talked about. There's also the ritual of sacrificing pigs, which they continue to do to this day. If there's any event that you have to communicate with the ancestors, you would sacrifice a pig or more pigs. And so, for example, if it's a really happy event, you get married, you want to announce to the ancestors there's a new relationship between these two people, two families. And so you sacrifice maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 pigs, maybe more if they've got big families. And then you split the meat among everyone. And so basically there's this traditional system of Gaia. There are also shamans. And then Christianity came in, and they tell me that when Christianity came in, they saw it as being compatible with their own Gaia. And they said that the most important values of Christianity, which are sharing and family and community, are all the values of Gaia. And so it was very easy for them to convert to Christianity.
Well, We'll move from Christianity to electoral politics, which is also something that's quite interesting, maybe especially for political scientists who might be listening to this podcast. How do elections intersect with community dynamics? And can you also talk a little bit about how Indigenous peoples fit within Taiwan's blue-green political divide?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to step back a little bit for those not familiar with Taiwanese politics. The green and blue, I think we have to explain that. But basically, the blues would be the more conservative ones. That's the KMT, Chinese Nationalist Party, that came to Taiwan with Chiang Kai-shek and after World War II, so in 1945. And, you know, they created a whole new system. And the Indigenous people, they actually had elections back then for local posts, like the provincial assembly and local township and village elections. And they participated in that. They had a quota for Indigenous representatives to the provincial assembly. All of this prior to the end of martial law and democratization at the higher levels of the government. And then, so we call them the blues now. They're the blue camp. And then in the social movement era of the 1980s, the opposition created the Democratic Progressive Party. And so we call those the Greens. And they tend to be much more closely linked to progressive social movements, and including the Indigenous rights movement, the environmental women, LGBT issues, all of these progressive things, are the Greens are there for that, more than the blues are. And so that's your blue and your green. It's your KMT versus the DPP. And so then the question about is, where do the Indigenous people fit in? And, you know, most people outside of Taiwan would guess that because the DPP talks about Indigenous rights all the time, Tsai Ing-wen, the president, even apologized right after getting elected for 400 years of colonization. So one would expect, if they're voting in terms of issues, that they would vote for, in large numbers, for the DPP, which talks a lot about Indigenous rights. But in fact, they vote overwhelmingly. I mean, it's really like 80-90%. It's like, it's not quite North Korea, but they really vote overwhelmingly for the KMT. And so that's a real puzzle for political scientists and political anthropologists to figure out. And so that's one of the two political issues I deal with in that chapter called Lulungan, heart, because the heart is the seat of ethical and moral reflection. And so basically, the DPP people like to say, well, all those Indigenous people, they're easily bought off and they're bribed. And I think there's a little bit of a racist sentiment there. Because these are intelligent people who are voting according to their own best interests. And I think that the KMT has, over decades and long before democratization, done a really good job of treating Indigenous peoples in ways that they want to be treated, often protecting them from outside investors, ensuring that there are 30 mountain townships in which outsiders cannot purchase land, guaranteeing them political representation at the township and provincial level and now at the national level. And the KMT has been really good at building up networks in those communities, really solid emotional ties, often intermarriage with local women. And so, because these people that came with Chiang Kai-shek, they're called mainlanders, Wai Sangren, and they've married into these communities. So people have relationships of kin with them and they feel very loyal. Like I said before, in Gaia, you take care of your community. And so they feel that sense of loyalty to the KMT. And so it's really easy for the KMT to spread their message and to really mobilize people to go out and vote. And, you know, part of Gaia as well is that they have these small groups of people that they have really close relations and they call it the people who eat together. And traditionally, those small groups of people would exchange labor. So let's say you need help on your rice fields or whatever you're growing, today, and then tomorrow we'll go work on somebody else's. And with this particular practice, they're able to mobilize people to go out and vote. And it's actually a lot of fun to be in these villages at election time, because there'll be these huge groups of people that go marching through the street, and they've got music and loudspeakers and like cars and jeeps and the handing out literature. And they've got these big feasts at the end of the day. All of the candidates do that. But it's generally the KMT that mobilizes the most votes. And so the DPP is there, but the real competition is usually between different factions of the KMT or other parties that might emerge, and so that are related to that KMT. You know? So it's quite interesting to see that happening.
Well, let's move from electoral politics to what you address in your penultimate chapter, which is about storytelling and memory within the Siddiq and Turku communities, especially in relation to the Musha incident, which you hinted at earlier in our conversation, and fans of Taiwanese cinema or action movies might know better as the subject of the 2011 epic film Siddiq Ballet. Tell us more about your findings here.
Yeah, well, I hope everybody watches this film, because I think it's a really great film. It's quite gory, but it's worth seeing. Siddiq Ballet, Warriors of the Rainbow. And in fact, the name of the book, Truly Human, is basically a Siddiq Ballet. So that's a word that they would use to praise somebody of strong moral character, the Siddiq Ballet, you know, a real mensch. And so that's why my two books about them, I use that. So I called it Truly Human in this book by Toronto Press. But anyway, I wrote this chapter. It's called Deminun. And I started the book with the animals and the hunting, and I wanted to kind of balance it out by having something about women's work. Because just like you have to be able to hunt to be a real man, to be a real woman, you have to be able to weave. And so the word for weaving is deminun. But that word has a lot of meanings in their language, and it also means weaving together stories. And so this chapter is about weaving together the stories through which they became Turugu and Siddiq. And this kind of goes back to your first question about, you know, what's special about Turugu and Siddiq and how did they become indigenous and so forth. But, you know, in the old days, before there was a state, all of these disparate groups across Taiwan, they didn't really have this idea of being a nation or an ethnic group or a tribe or whatever. They were just people. And they all had a word for human in their language. And so there's Bunun, and there's Siddiq, and there's Dao and Dayan. All of these are different groups in Taiwan, and they all mean human. So basically what happened is when the Japanese came and they wanted to, because states have to classify different peoples into different groups, they can control who lives where, who pays taxes and all of that. And so the Japanese sent these anthropologists to try to figure out which tribes they belong to. And they would go to the communities and say, well, who are you? You know, what should we call you? And when they got to the Siddiq, what happened is they asked them, what are you? And they said, well, we're not animals. We're not monkeys. We're not deer. We're Siddiq. They just meant we're human. And so the Japanese, they created these nine categories. And finally, they picked Dayan, a Tayal, to cover a larger group of people, including what are now the Siddiq and the Turugu. And Turugu, they call themselves Siddiq Turugu in their language. So if they're not speaking Chinese, they'll call them Siddiq Turugu. Siddiq means people, and Turugu means it's a place up high in the mountains. So it's with terraced land. And so it basically means mountain people. But the word Siddiq is still there. But then what happened is with democratization, there were different groups of people that wanted to split away from the Ataya. And the first ones were the Turugu, who became Tailukudzu in Chinese, or Turugu, in 2004. And then the Siddiq got their identity in 2008, and the state recognized them. And now there are 16 officially recognized groups. And so there was like confederations of little communities that decided to become Turugu, and another confederation that decided to become Siddiq. And they did that. But then they have to convince everybody else in their group that this change is a good thing. And so they weave together the stories. And so this chapter is really that, about how they became Turugu and Sedek as two different indigenous nations. And so I engaged with some indigenous authors there on both sides. And one of them is the Battle for Taroko, which was in 1914. And then the other one, which is really big in Taiwan because of that film, is what's called the Musha Incident in Japanese. And it was the 1930 rebellion in which they rose up. It was a big, dramatic historical incident. It's deeply graved in their way of being and their identity. Because what happened is, with among the Sedek Kataya, there were 12 alang, or 12 groups. And Mona Ludau, who was this leader, he went around and tried to get them to join forces against the Japanese. And six of those groups said they would do it, and six of them refused. One of them, actually in the community of Musha, he said, "I'm not going to go. We're not going to fight with you, but if your women need shelter and your children need shelter, they can come to us." And that group also sheltered the Japanese. And so this happened on October 27, 1930, which was a very important day for the Japanese. It was commemorating a Japanese prince that had been killed in the takeover of Taiwan. And so they forced everybody to go to the schoolyard. And just as they were raising the Japanese flag and beginning to sing the anthem, then the warriors attacked and they started to kill all of the Japanese who were present. And so that's basically the beginning of the Musha incident, and that's what historians usually call the Musha incident, is that uprising. From the Sedek perspective, there are actually two Musha incidents. The first one is after the uprising, the Japanese used the most modern military means possible. They even used poison gases, which was illegal at the time, against really these people who had no weapons to fight back. And so that was the first, from the Sedek perspective, the first Musha incident is when the Japanese had this reprisal against them. It killed a lot of people. It was a real Holocaust. And so then they took the survivors and they put them into a detention camp. And there were always hostilities between different groups. And so the Japanese then mobilized a group that was hostile against these groups. And they attacked them in the detention center and killed many others. And so they were really left with a very small population. And the Japanese put them they were originally up high in the mountains and in different communities. And they put the very few survivors into an island in the middle of the river, and down in the plains, and made them live there. It was heavily guarded. They say it was like a concentration camp, and they had to like get Japanese guards to escort them into town if they wanted to buy something. They were under surveillance for a long time. And there were suicides. People died from tropical diseases down there. It was, you know, a really founding moment to their history. And so it's important to talk about that. And actually, a bit more than the film.
Yeah, the film has a lot of headings, but definitely doesn't go into all the aspects of the history. And I mean, the film is also quite interesting from a perspective of just its role in constructing Taiwan's modern, you know, national identity. And I think that's a good transition point to talking about what you discuss in the conclusion and the epilogue around what the future might hold for indigenous peoples in Taiwan on two fronts. One is the relationship with the Taiwan or ROC state apparatus, and then two is Taiwan's relationship with China. What should people who aren't necessarily specialists in Taiwan, but maybe just see it as, you know, a geopolitical flashpoint on the cover of The Economist or something like that, know about its indigenous peoples and how they interface with these two issues that we just brought up here?
Yeah, so I think the first issue is the Republic of China State, which is the state here. Confusingly, with that name on Taiwan, it still is the official name of the country, the state. And So I think that what they're trying to do is to create greater substantial autonomy, some kind of recognition of their sovereignty. And so I think that the first step that needs to be done is each one of these 16 groups needs to be recognized as being a legal person, so that just like the Navajo can do, they can actually sign agreements with the state and with corporations. I think that's very important. I think that, and this is probably the conclusion of the book, is that their legal and moral and spiritual system of Gaia is still alive and it still guides them, and it can guide them in that relationship with the state as well. And I think all of the other groups, they've got something similar to Gaia. So I was focusing on Sedek, Drugu, but their other ones have something similar. And so there's that relationship, which is something that they can negotiate because it's a democratic state. And even though there's resistance, I think that a lot of the politicians and ordinary people in Taiwan think, why should indigenous people have right to sovereignty that others don't have? You know what? It has to do with being indigenous, that there are special legal frameworks internationally and domestically in Taiwan that give the indigenous people certain rights, including the right to autonomy and self-government that other communities don't have. So that's that relationship with the ROC. But then there's this big question that always looms over Taiwan studies, and that's the People's Republic of China, which says that Taiwan is an inalienable part of the People's Republic of China, and that they want to unify by all means, even if military means are necessary to get there. And what's interesting is that in 2019, Xi Jinping, I think everybody knows his name nowadays, but he made a speech in memory of an earlier speech by Deng Xiaoping to the so-called compatriots of Taiwan, in which he kind of reiterated this. It's always been there. But he reiterated that they want peaceful reunification, and if they don't get that, they'll use military means. And then the indigenous peoples of Taiwan, some people at the presidential office had set up this transitional justice and a committee for indigenous people, and they came up with a statement in which they said that the indigenous peoples of Taiwan have always been the sovereign nations of this land. And we might not be happy with some things that the government does, but nonetheless, we want to create a new Taiwan with all of the peoples of Taiwan. And we do not accept what Xi Jinping has said. And so I talk about that in the epilogue. And I think that the conclusion is that Taiwan's liberal democracy is still much better for the indigenous peoples, in spite of all of the problems that exist in liberal democracies, than what China offers. Because here's this other alternative on the horizon. And I think all we have to do is look at the way that China treats the Uyghurs and the Tibetans and other minorities to know that if ever Taiwan were to become incorporated into the People's Republic of China, by violent or even by peaceful means, I think there is a very real danger that all of these dreams of sovereignty and self-government would get cast aside, and there could be a real genocide there, just like with the Uyghurs. And so I'm mostly afraid of that. And so that's why I added that epilogue to that. And I think it's important to get that word out there.
Yeah, definitely important for, you know, folks not just very focused on indigenous studies and anthropology, but beyond, to note this dimension to the relationship between Taiwan and China, as well as just things happening within the indigenous communities on Taiwan. Well, you've been working on this book. Probably, what, 2 decades or more of work has been put into this. My next question and final question is, what are you working on next?
Yeah, well, I've got a brand, not really a brand new project, but since 2017, I've had a new project. It's called Austronesian World. So it's they speak Austronesian language. So it's kind of looking at this part of the world, but I'm looking at it bigger. And so I actually did a year of research in Japan. Now I'm in Taiwan for 1 year of field work. And it's looking at all of the different peoples who inhabit this space in the Western Pacific and how they have created their lives in very local ways in different places in the relations they have with all of the other living beings around them. including the animals they hunt, including the birds that might come to their rice fields, and the birds they tell stories about. And they've created cultures and ways of beings that are always tied to other non-human lives as well. And so I that's what I'm working on now. It was always there. You know, the cover of the book here has this little bird here. It's called Shishil. And so the Sedek and Turugu, it's their national symbol. And when they hunt, you know, they look at the bird, and if it flies on the right-hand side of the path, it's a good sign. If it's on the left-hand side, they should not even bother hunting because they won't catch anything. And if it makes noises and flies in front of them, it's a very bad sign. Something's happened in their village and they should go back. And so that's an example of the kind of entanglements that we have with different animals and then with birds. And it's nothing completely exotic. I think that, you know, the bald eagle and the Americans have a relationship. And that's why that's the national symbol of the United States. And so it's, you know, around the world, humans have always woven together cultures and ways of being in the world by imagining the animals and the plants and the worlds around them in very local, specific ways. And so I'm looking at that across Taiwan, and I'm going to do field work continuously with the Sedek and Durugu, but also go to Orchid Island and also work with Chinese somewhat populations on the Amazu just off the coast of Fujian, and also in Tainan, which is really the heart of Taiwan in many ways. It's where the Dutch set up. I'm going to be at Chiku, and they have a kind of bird there, which is almost like a national symbol of Taiwan as well, which is the black-faced spoonbill. And so I'm just going to hang out with people and see how they imagine those other beings around them and tie together identities and cultures.
Well, look forward to learning and reading more about birds, indigeneity, interaction between them, whatever comes out of that even further. But for now, thank you very much, Scott, for helping us learn about this dimension of indigenous life, these specific communities in Taiwan. Listeners, if you want to learn more about what we discussed in this episode, look for Scott Simon's latest book, Truly Human, Indigeneity and Indigenous Resurgence on Formosa. Scott, thanks again for coming on the New Books Network.
Yep, thank you, Anthony. It was a pleasure.